Hello and welcome to The Sower. My name is James Patterson. I'm president of the Ciceronian Society and also associate professor and chair of politics at Ave Maria University, fellow at the Center for Religion, Culture, and Democracy, and at the Institute for Human Ecology. Today, we have our guest, Professor Glenn Moots. You're an associate professor of political science at Northwood University. Am I right about this?
Full professor.
Professor. Listen to you.
It's very important. I get discounts on coffee that way.
They add up.
Well, the tire rotation, too. I mean, that's 10, 15 bucks right there.
Oh, no, they're cutting that benefit. You know that's going down the tubes.
But, yeah, Northwood, and I have been there. I'm coming up on 25 years. No, wait. Wait. 30. 30 years if you include part-time at Northwood.
Right. My now, goodness.
30 years, yeah.
They're definitely going to name a bench after you. Today is July 7th. I forgot to mention today's July 7th, 2023. It's not January 7th, 2023, when we originally planned on doing this podcast. Months ago. It has been a nightmare to make this happen. And we finally made it happen. Today we had a number of things go wrong. So if we're a little punchy, it's because the things that went wrong included me not turning my headphones on. And I'm also sick. Glenn just muted himself. There we go. So today we're going to be talking about a not so funny topic. So maybe that's the other reason why I'm being a little silly, which is the subject of Christian nationalism. Now, Glenn,
I muted myself out of deference to others who would prefer that I be muted.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. So what do you think of this timeline on the subject of Christian nationalism? So you have the nomination and election of Donald Trump and the realization that 81% of white evangelicals voted for him, the attribution to those white evangelicals by the left that those people were Christian nationalists. I have here Taking Back God for America by Whitehead and Perry, The Power Worshippers by Catherine Stewart, and The Religion of American Greatness by Paul Miller, who I know. I don't know the other two authors of the other two books. And what emerged as a result of this attribution was a kind of appropriation of the term by certain people among conservative Protestants. And that's, for example, what Stephen Wolfe did in his book in The Case for Christian Nationalism, which comes out after these books, strangely enough. Normally, people would advance an idea and then they'd be criticized for it, but instead the criticism came first. What happened here?
Oh, that's a good question. I think you can go back to 2006, right? Michelle Goldberg's book, Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. There was another book whose title escapes me by Ingersoll that I actually reviewed along with McVicker's biography of Rush Dooney, which I think was really, really good. If you have listeners who were interested in Christian Reconstruction, I really recommend McVicker's book. So I guess first thing I'd say is the idea of Christian nationalism, insofar as academics have been writing pieces, what I would call alarmist and not very good academic pieces about it, has been around before Trump. Mark Hall, who you know at George Fox, and I think he's going to be at Regent now. He's going to have some affiliation with both Regent University in Virginia. Mark has done some good work on this, you know, longstanding, almost 20-year concern about Christian nationalism. But to your question about Donald Trump, What do you think changed? Do you think the first shot on this was fired By the left or by the right?
It's just that the term itself was new to me. I remember people used to refer to it as Christian fundamentalism. That was partly a self-identifier, but when it was used by critics, it was also meant to kind of remind the listener of Islamic fundamentalism during the 1970s. And that was sort of during the first wave of opposition to conservative Protestantism being politically mobilized, first under Falwell and then under Robertson and the Christian Coalition. So the moniker of Christian nationalism, I thought, was not necessarily new, but it was new in its prominence.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the old concern, if I'm thinking back to Ingersoll's book, was worrying about things like Vision Forum kids running around in George Washington costumes, people who believed in, you know, a 6-day, 24-hour day creation, like, you know, Ken Ham and things like that. And so,
premillennial dispensationalism, apocalypticism, stuff like that.
Well, in Christian Reconstruction.
Yeah.
So that all was thrown into a big basket called dominionism, right?
Right.
And so after Trump, what you get, especially insofar as evangelicals were being miscast as being such diehard Trump supporters, and my understanding is that they really were not that supportive of Trump in the primaries, but did line up behind him in 16. Is that right?
That's right. In fact, Tim Carney at AEI does some really great work on this, where the people who were most enthusiastic earliest for Trump were the unchurched. And you had a lot of real misgivings among very churched Protestants, like the Dutch Reformed in Western Michigan were very reluctant to get on board until the general election.
Yeah, right. So I think that's where I remember that from is Carney's book too, although I think I probably saw it a couple other places. So you had this mischaracterization of the evangelical support, and you had the kind of loosey-goosey definition of what an evangelical was, right? So you had people who identified themselves as Christians, but when you came down to things like regular church attendance, church membership, you know, interest in the sacraments, you know, you really get into the weeds on what constitutes devotion or identification, right? It gets increasingly complicated. So, and of course, there I think was just this propensity to focus on the strangest, oddest, you know, the snake handlers, if you will, among the evangelicals, so that they would look even more radical and crazy and irrational. So, I don't think Trump was ever really interested, right, in Christianity. He was so new to pro-life that he wound up saying things that, you know, what I would consider to be the majority of pro-lifers did not agree with, right, in terms of some of the positions that he started to take.
Right, like the arresting of a woman who has an abortion.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's a non-starter on the right and among pro-lifers.
Well, among most. I mean, there are some who do, and you know, we don't need to get into particulars on that, but it just, I did not see among the people that Trump appointed, I did not see... I didn't understand why, or I don't understand why, because Trump was elected, everybody had to go, you know, DEFCON. Is it DEFCON 1 or DEFCON 5? DEFCON 1 is the worst, right? That's
sounds bad. All the DEFCONs sound bad. I'll just be honest.
Okay,
I'm not sure what the rank is.
We'll just say, you know, going DEFCON about Christian nationalism because Trump was elected. Right.
What DEFCON is finding cocaine near the Situation Room, Glenn?
That's DEF CON H.
What on earth could H stand? Anyway, this by the, you know, people will be listening to this a year from now and have no idea what we're talking about.
I know I feel better that the Secret Service can't possibly figure out where that came from.
It is the most surveilled building in the world, and somehow we can't find who put the giant bag of cocaine. This is definitely appropriate for the Cicerone Society. Actually, this is 100% what the Cicerone Society is like if you go to the meetings. So how about this as a kind of a periodization of sort of left, center-left interpretations of Christian right? You have kind of the Elmer Gantry phase of Falwell to Robertson. And then you have the sort of compassionate, conservative, hypocritical, psychotic soccer mom during the winsome days of like Rick Warren, purpose-driven evangelicalism up until Trump. And then it's the middle-aged man with a goatee and wraparound Oakleys driving a large truck and is the drunk uncle at the Thanksgiving dinner who talks about QAnon. That's sort of like the periodization, right?
I think you've offered a much more memeable parallel to Aaron Wren's positive, neutral, negative world there, James. But yeah, I see that. I mean, he has to have a beard, but
he does.
I think, maybe one of those inappropriate flags. But yeah.
Definitely has a Punisher sticker. What is Christian nationalism now, right? So when it was like this attributed feature, it was one thing. Now there's an attempt to actually form a coherent sort of message behind it, right?
I'll tell you what's made it interesting to me, but I don't know how representative I am. I mean, this is one of the problems of social media, mainstream media, insofar as both have become an echo chamber. It's really hard to get a sense of, you know, who thinks what. So, you know, you'd mentioned some of the books that have been published expressing concern. You know, in some cases, real pants on fire about Christian nationalism, and really not very good in terms of defining what it is or why people should be concerned about it, et cetera. But
Glenn, America Back for God won the 2021 Distinguished Award from the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion. So I'm not sure why you're being such a sad, angry man about that.
Well, I stand corrected.
When would they ever side with very thinly veiled partisan and ideological research?
When I get
off, that's not scientific. That would not be the scientific study of religion. But this clearly says that it is right here on the back of this book.
Yeah, I think you just said it all, and anybody who's ever been around, you know, APSA or a host of other
American Political Science Association for those who aren't in the know.
Yeah, no, you know, just how politicized it is. And we don't even have to get into the way in which all the professions are increasingly politicized. But what was interesting to me, like what is interesting to me about Stephen's book?
Stephen Wolfe's book, The Case for Christian Nationalism.
Right. Yeah, and I've known Stephen a while. He went through LSU's doctoral program, as I did, although years apart. Is insofar as Stephen is recovering elements of magisterial Protestantism, and we can talk about that in a second. It's interesting to me. That's the thing that's most interesting to me, and I think that will give whatever this movement is, something worth talking about. Implementation in politics always comes down to prudence, but it will certainly give us a good place to start and something to talk around And that's really what's most interesting to me. So, for example, the Iskar Torba book or whatever it is, I just haven't paid any attention to it because I don't think those guys know anything about it. There's probably some of it, like I understand that book is still running on some of the Reconstructionist fumes, like, some theonomy or things like that. And we can talk about Christian Reconstruction too, if you want to, but I think increasingly, whatever Christian nationalism is, and I know like Brad Littlejohn has talked about, thinking of it more, not as nationalism, but as a commonwealth project, a discussion about what a commonwealth is, what the common good is, what the purpose of politics is, which I think is important. Insofar as it's a recovery, and I don't mean a recovery like we just do what they did, but insofar as it's a recovery, which is the start of a conversation around magisterial Protestantism, that I think is probably the new turn in Christian nationalism, at least as far as I'm concerned or what I'm most interested in. How's that?
That's fine. And let's start with that subject of magisterial Protestantism before we get into Stephen's book. We don't have to spend the entire rest of the podcast talking about Stephen's book, but there's a few things in it I wanted to pose. But before we get into it, what is this recovery of magisterial Protestantism? For those who don't know or may have heard about it and are uncertain about what it is, this has been something that's been afoot for a while, and you've been at the center of doing this, if I'm any judge as an outsider.
Magisterial Protestantism, which sounds like a bunch of Protestants who are have like a gold leaf edge to them, and they drink
golden white leafed edge.
Magisterial simply means that the reforming efforts of the magisterial Protestants included the civil magistrate. So magistrate, magisterial. So. This is not really a big oversimplification. There's a little bit of a simplification, but so in the Reformation, you had two groups of Protestants. You had Protestants who did not want to engage the civil magistrate and were, in fact, quite scandalized by the thought of it. And those are typically lumped under the idea of the Anabaptists, right? The group called the Anabaptists. And then when you think about Lutherans, Anglicans, Presbyterians, to some degree Congregationalists, at least the American ones, you're talking about magisterial Protestants. So the magistrate was going to help carry forward the work of the Reformation. And don't forget, too, that rejecting the authority of Rome meant that you had created something of a vacuum, not only because Rome had asserted authority over the civil magistrate, but also Rome was where you found the head or the seat of the church. So if you reject that authority, you've got a pretty big authority vacuum, and that I think it's understandable and even biblical to have a role for the civil magistrate.
Yeah, so we have here... since you're talking about the magistrate, we have here this discussion in Wolfe's book of the Christian prince. I'll just read a little bit of it. For those who have the book, it's on page 292. When we designate any prince as a Christian prince, we are not simply referring to his religion, nor are we saying that his office is fundamentally of grace, as if Christian prince is entirely a creation of the gospel. The Christian prince occupies the natural office of civil ruler. It is not fundamentally a new office, though the office is Christianized by his service to Christ. The Christian prince retains everything pertaining to the office of civil ruler, considered generically. We can then come to this definition. The Christian prince is a civil ruler as divinely ordained in nature, who possesses and uses both civil and interpersonal to order his people to commodious temporal life and to the eternal life in Christ. So is this where magisterial Protestants land, or is this merely Wolfe's interpretation?
Can we just talk about the pros for a second?
If you like.
I know people who are really put off by that, but if you spend your time in the early stuff, which Stephen has done more than, I don't know, I don't want to put a hard number on it, but the vast majority, I don't want to say all, but the vast majority of people who are talking, well, certainly they're talking about Christian nationalism, and he's probably gone through more of those sources on politics than certainly than almost all American political theorists, not the Brits. The Brits have been doing work on this for years, but that prose is just reflects, I think, how deeply Stephen is in those sources.
So commodious is definitely not a commonly used word unless you are in the sources.
Right. And he uses commodious a lot. I guess I'm answering your question, which is, I think Stephen always knows what's in the magisterial Protestants. I think he also knows when he departs from it. And I think to Stephen's credit, he's also trying to distill a lot. You know, people have complained about the length of the book, but I think he's actually done a really good job in some places of distilling what would otherwise be a much, much larger book. The idea of the Christian magistrate. So I want to be careful. I don't want to endorse the Christian prince, because I think that the weakest part of Stephen's book, and he acknowledged this in a Twitter post, is that I don't think he's that interested in institutions, what I would call constitutionalism. In other words, building the kind of mouse maze where when you get to the end of it, based on how you've allocated power and how you understand the use of law and things like that, you get a better outcome. I don't think he's that interested in it. And so I think in his book and among some people who have patted him on the back, and we won't go into naming names on that, they want a prince, they want a single ruler in the model of the strong monarch, let's just call it the Stuart monarchy, although they probably wouldn't like that association, but
we know where that goes, right?
Well, I mean, James the First and Charles the First, I mean, you know, if you read what they said, they basically said, you know, the prince is essentially above the law, though he is certainly able to put himself under it if he wants to. That kind of thing, you know, gives me hives. You know, I don't care for that. But the idea of the Christian magistrate as someone whose office is from God, who does not simply have a responsibility to be a night watchman, but actually has a kind of robust responsibility for both the spiritual and physical well-being of the citizens, as well as a responsibility to provide some. And this is the part where people are going to, you know, just probably lose it, oversight or responsibility for the church. Now, if you've read, again, if you've read the sources on this, like if you read Althusius, this is not what people think it is. This is not that the civil magistrate is the head of the church. And we don't have to get into the weeds in Althusius or whatever, but I'll say this and I'll turn it back to you, which is, the exact relationship of civil and ecclesiastical authority was, you know, kind of hashed and rehashed over a long period of time. And it's not just as simple as the one is autonomous or one rules over the other, et cetera. But that gets pretty complicated. And the magisterials don't always agree on it. And they don't always implement it the same way.
So in 182... Wolfe says the classical Protestant position is that civil authorities ought to order outward goods to this highest good, or put differently, to establish and maintain the best possible outward conditions for people to acquire spiritual good, that's being the highest good. Their objects of action are things circa sacra, around sacred things. This can include the funding of church construction, ministerial and seminary financial support, the suppression of public blasphemy, heresy, and impious profanation, obligating Sabbath observance, and other things. I like the and other things.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's right.
The extent and nature of such policies will vary with circumstances. In accepting these limitations, civil authorities recognize a distinction or separation of church and state. The instituted church is the God-ordained order that administers spiritual things for the good of the soul. It offers the highest good. Having the office of the word, it wields the spiritual sword to change hearts for eternal life. Civil authorities do not have this sword. Nevertheless, civil authorities can serve the body politic by making it outwardly fit for receiving what is good for the soul.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that Wolf, or is that what you think is a kind of comprehensive vision of magisterial Protestantism?
I think that's actually a pretty good summary of magisterial Protestantism.
So we've seen some degree of those things in the history of the United States. A lot of people today probably are surprised to hear someone make recommendations like this. It sounds very theocratic, but it's not that long ago where you had things like Sunday closure laws, and you certainly in some states still have blue laws for the purchase of alcohol, and you had versions of Sabbath laws, and there was also moral laws, the laws about what you could not do in public, and of course we had church establishments until 1833. How untoward, how un-American is this? If you're a critic of Christian nationalism, this will sound to you as like an alien ideology seeking to usurp the rights of people. But is it really that foreign?
Short answer is no. And I guess the first thing I'll point to, a couple things that I would say in response to that. As a preliminary, I'll just say I understand why people feel this way. So I think the next question is whether they're willing to kind of get over the initial shock or reaction to that. I'm thinking, for example, of the study which was discussed. It's been in The Economist, Christian Post, Breakpoint, which I think is Chuck Colson's organization. You know, they've been talking about this now since the end of last year, which is a study about deaths of despair that also included blue laws. And we'll just put under the heading of blue laws, laws having to do with the Sabbath. So if, for example, you believed that church attendance is a salutary thing, it's an important part of human flourishing, then you can kind of put that on a spectrum. And at the one spectrum, you could have the most extreme position, which is that you try to force confessions of faith out of people. I'm not aware of any Protestants who thought that was a good idea. I've heard Protestants say that Roman Catholics were at one time willing to do that. I'll let you speak to that. I'm not going to presume to know anything about that. But at the other end, you could simply have something like a law which says you can't open until noon. That doesn't make anybody do anything. It just makes it just gives them fewer excuses not to go to church. Does that make sense?
Right. That is how I've understood it. What's funny is that during a extended period when Catholics were trying to more or less prove themselves as good patriots, they also supported things like closure laws. And this is one of the things that often surprises people, is they were also supportive of temperance, which, you know, runs contrary to many of the reputations of Catholics in the United States. The Knights of Columbus were advocates for temperance. So this is not all that uncommon, but all the same, there's still a lot of displeasure about Stephen Wolfe's project, leaving out the obvious problems that people on the left or center left are going to have with any kind favorable legislation toward church attendance. What are some of the criticisms that are among those who would normally be sympathetic to Stephen's project?
Of the book or of Stephen's...
The book and the project, like his sort of broader oeuvre.
So what I appreciate about Stephen's book, I'm not very good at answering your questions right away, am I? What I like about Stephen's book is, for example, that passage you just read, which I think is a good summary of how magisterial Protestants understood the magistrate. But like I said, there are elements of that chapter on the Christian Prince, and I don't have the book in front of me, but where I think, again, what he's asking for is some kind of strong executive, I would say too strong, that can start to look like, it can start to look like a fascist articulation of the state, the kind of all-encompassing nature of the state, or the idea of the strong personality leading the people who only find their meaning as members of the state, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that's not magisterial Protestantism, and I'm not saying Stephen is a fascist, but if one is not, in my opinion, more careful about addressing questions of institutions, their relationship to one another, the rule of law, constitutionalism, et cetera, it can sure look that way. And I think that's a weakness in his project. And I've said as much in a review. This isn't anything new or I hope scandalous. This is something that I said clearly in my review of the book at Public Discourse.
Yeah, so Josh Abbotoy, he's that American reformer, Claremont Lincoln Fellow. You know, he more or less drilled down on this particular vision of the Christian Prince by saying on Twitter... we've referred to that social media site a couple times. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that. But he said, basically, America is going to need a Protestant Franco. Now, I want to mention, first of all, that if you were to tell Franco that we need a Protestant Franco, he would absolutely lose his mind. given Franco's thoroughgoing public Christianity, Catholicism, which was sufficiently brain poisoned that he was, you know, doing all sorts of terrible things to even dissenting Catholic priests, you know, the idea that we were going to have a Protestant version of him in the United States would appall him. But this sort of declaration for the need of a extra constitutional executive leader to centralize the national government seems to be where a lot of people who are interested in Stephen's project want to take it. To your point about institutions, this really does seem to indicate an indifference or even ignorance of how institutions work. It's worth noting that Protestant Franco, if he were to have the same conclusion as a Catholic Franco did, it would mean the impoverishment of the country, the alignment of the country with Nazi Germany, and then quickly pivoting to the Allies in 1944 when things seemed to be going the other direction, marginalization of the country in the international community for decades, economic deterioration well behind the rest of Western Europe. And then unfortunately, the Protestant Franco will die of an aggravated abscess and his arse, from sitting too long on a couch watching football. So is this really like a serious project?
I think what you just were angling for there was to get on the writing staff for the new Indiana Jones. which I saw, by the way, I thought it was good. But anyway, we got to politicize everything. So
did you see the joke about how the most realistic part of the movie was that an 80-year-old professor wouldn't retire?
That's outstanding.
I know. He's, instead of taking the buyout, he's going to go find some dial.
So I would simply address this from the magisterials. And, you know, one of the interesting things about what made the magisterials, especially the Reformed, or what sometimes are called Calvinistic. I think Reformed's a better label than Calvinistic. But what makes them so prolific is they have to kind of sort out these questions of the relationship of Henry VIII to Rome. That's Tyndale's Obedience of a Christian Man, which is not read properly. That's not anything new or unique, but that's been said before, and I just went through that again with classes this semester. And then you have the Marian exile, and you have Protestants going to the continent and having to sort through constitutional questions about how much authority the monarch should have and who the monarch is accountable to. And you already had all of this complicated medieval constitutionalism that the Protestants inherited. So what I don't understand is why we would be excited about centralizing authority when none of the people that at the same time were saying are such good and important guides, such meat, right, and salutary guides for us to think about politics anew. Why we would say, for example, well, these guys understood the role of Sabbath laws, but then turn around and say, let's centralize authority. And then you say, well, actually, the magisterial Protestants didn't like that. So to me, I guess all I can say is I think it's a selective reading of the magisterial Protestants, and I would prefer to read them consistently and have a conversation around everything that they're saying. I don't just want to say, well, they like blue laws, so do I, but they like constitutionalism, but we don't. What we really need is someone who can, on the strength of their personality or their religious devotion or, you know, some kind of aggregation of powers inconsistent with Anglo-American constitutionalism. And I don't say that like it's something separate from Protestantism. I say it is something that was very woven into Protestantism. And John Adams said as much when he cited both the Vindicia Contra Chirinos and John Ponet's work on politics that he wrote in exile from Mary. Stop me if I'm going on too long
here. This is good. I'm very glad that you were saying what you're saying. This is good.
You know, I don't see how you can have it both ways. It seems to me that if you're going to say that the magisterial Protestants took the sort of kind of holistic view of human good and human flourishing, and therefore they encourage Sabbath laws, that part of that holistic view includes limits on power. So, you know, you're just going to have to work it out. Now, if it doesn't work out, then you just have to do what's prudent. And somebody says to me, well, you know, and this is one of the problems too, is that somebody will say to me, because, you know, I'm on record as either defending Christian people who are Christian nationalists, like Stephen. I just went to bat. I really had a bigger point than going to bat for Stephen, but I've gone to bat for Stephen on occasion. I've also been critical of him. And I have a Nat Con talk, which is kind of tongue-in-cheek, entitled How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Christian Nationalism. It was adapted at Long Liberty, if somebody wants to read it. But, you know, to me, the important thing is we start and talk around the magisterial Protestants, and it means that we do it without cherry picking them. How's that?
I think that's right. One of the features of Christian nationalism that has paralleled my observations of something, a very similar development on my side of the denominational divide, something called Catholic integralism. We can talk about that in a minute, but has been that they confront the reality that does not square with the ideal theory they establish, and when confronted, respond with, well, we'll just use force until it works the way that we're supposed to. And what's strange is that in both cases where force has been applied, I'd say there has not been much success. Rather, there's been a lot of failure. And I was wondering, since I know this to be how the church among the Catholics responded, which was to back away, it seems like the magisterial Protestants were already well aware that it doesn't work that great because they were the ones originally subject to force by Catholic civil magistrates. You referred to Mary many times there. She was one of those civil magistrates, right?
Yeah, right. Mary the First. There's a lot of Marys floating around in that period. So Mary Tudor, Mary Queen of Scots, Mary the First. She became the ruler of England after Edward. So Edward took over from Henry, and Henry was not terribly interested in reforming the church. I mean, he originally was an opponent of Luther, which earned him the title Defender of the Faith, which I feel like every time there's a coronation and they call the English monarch the Defender of the Faith, they're trolling the Pope, right? Because he's the faith that he's defending is the Protestant faith, and I think Charles was still charged with doing that. There's some controversy over whether, you know, how he was going to, you know, handle that, or they're going to change the ceremony or whatever. But Edward was very interested in reforming the church. Henry just sort of tolerated it, I think, and let Cranmer, you know, do what Cranmer did, including, you know, the Book of Common Prayer, right, which is just such a wonderful contribution to the church and to civilization generally. But anyway, I think that's right. And I think that made them sensitive to questions of power and authority, like you said. And even though you did see them sometimes say, oh, you know, this is absolutely wrong, when they were on the outs and then they went and got into power and were more willing to do some of those things, or at least to be less, you know, less critical than they would have been before, I think they were still pretty consistent. I think the conversation, whether they were in or out of power, was around those questions of authority and worrying about it being abused, as well as not crossing lines of ecclesiastical and civil authority in an imprudent or unbiblical or unprecedented way. How's that?
Yeah, the Catholic in me is wanting to say, well, you know, what about priest tolls, the oath of supremacy? But I'm also remembering that the Vatican called for the unseating of Elizabeth the First. You know, high drama, you know, things got ratcheted up a lot. But when the project came across the Atlantic to the United States, you had the sort of like low intensity establishment of Southern and Mid-Atlantic states and the high intensity ones in New England states. And the use of coercion there was like oddly ineffective, especially against like the Baptists, and their struggle. Right.
Did you just come up with that high intensity, low intensity?
Yes.
I like that.
Oh, you're thank you.
Okay. See, this isn't just a podcast. This is
a workshop.
It's a yeah. Let's see if we'll get APSA.
It started here. We're gonna have a co-author. It's gonna win the 2024. here, what? Oh, I put the book away. Book of the year, the scientific study of religion. I can see it coming.
We could always become the Christianity Today Book of the Year too.
Oh well.
I would say the odds of that happening are as slim as the APSA.
The Commonweal Book of the Year.
Anywho.
I'm pretty sure that you would abandon public life if that were to happen to you.
You know, I wrote I wrote a chapter on the colonial establishments for Owen Anderson, Michael Breidenbach's Cambridge Companion of the First Amendment. And
Michael Breidenbach being a colleague of mine and an excellent, excellent scholar.
Right, and we're all part of the James Madison
Mafia.
Right. I was going to say Society First, then Mafia, but we should just go straight to the Mafia part.
Yeah, you know.
So I wrote it on in there, and then also Mark Hall and Dan Dreisbach did.
Mark Hall also in the Mafia.
Yep. And
has Dreisbach done a JMP?
Dan?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a good question.
It's almost like he doesn't have to.
It would be shocking if he wasn't.
Yeah. Honorary, if not official.
Yeah, definitely. So Mark and Dan did a volume on great Christian jurists. I did a chapter on John Cotton and Roger Williams in there. So the point of this is not self-promotion. The point is to say that having focused on what I think was the most important theoretical debate about establishment between Williams and Cotton, and having looked at some of the historical particulars of those establishments, though I'm not an historian, nor do I play one on TV. I think that the reason we have toleration in America, primarily, and I'll just say, even before I say this, that Andrew Murphy said this 20 years ago. Andrew's now at Michigan, which I'm really, really, really happy about in political science department. Is that this was, I think, this the debates about toleration really did not move things in the direction of toleration. I think that toleration was moved largely by questions of expedience. And that's really important because if it was determined by rulers in the magisterial tradition that it was prudent to have toleration leading increasingly toward religious liberty, then toleration and liberty is not something we should discount. We might say on grounds of principle, we think it would be better for people to have something that looks more like establishment, all right? And I'm going to leave that pretty vague because that comes down to questions of localism and federalism and prudence and all the rest. But you could say, well, in principle, we may like this, but prudence is also a principle. And you can also refuse to do something, and it doesn't make you a squish normie. It means that you understand that politics is the art of the possible. And as Althusius says in his conclusion on ecclesiastical administration, he says, look, if you try to do what I'm recommending here and all you're going to do is sow sedition and discord, don't do it. So you have to recognize the importance of the polity. That gets back to constitutionalism, questions of human flourishing, et cetera, et cetera. And again, you're always talking around those questions of, you know, what is best under the circumstances, because remember, circumstances themselves are the work of God. That's providence.
Yeah. So the rather than looking to force, right, this idea that the magic comes from the exercise of unilateral power by a civil magistrate, what you use is virtue, right? That's what prudence is for the statesman or stateswoman. Is that that's so ungainly? And
statesperson.
Also, statesperson. That's worse.
States human.
That speciesist, Glenn, you're canceled. That approach. Thereby requires the use of prudence. It's not sufficient to expect a prince to possess such prudence. In fact, to exercise prudence would be to expect a prince not to possess it, and therefore you're back to the question of institutions that have public legitimacy, and political support from a wide range of people, and therefore can exercise in good faith the compromise where there is so much disagreement. And this is the arrival at first what's called the Protestant hegemony. It's Daryl Hart's description, in which all the Protestants agree in the United States that nobody gets an establishment, and especially the Catholics, and then eventually the Mormons. And then there's a kind of radiating outward after that, in which other groups are then included in the, and so you end up with things like the Judeo-Christian consensus as a term. And what holds the whole thing together is that nobody gets a state sponsorship. And as it turns out, that's a pretty stable way of doing things. So there's no state favoritism, but it's also the opposite of what Stephen Wolfe says.
Right? Well, yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, Stephen's very smart, and I don't know, you know, between the time that he wrote this and now, I don't know, you know, if you were to put that to him and say, hey, have you abandoned institutions, or have you abandoned constitutionalism? You know, I'm always somebody who wants to stand up for an author when somebody says, you know, for example, you've heard the criticisms of Locke, you know, well, Locke doesn't say there are families in the state of nature and you know, that sort of thing. And you think, well, look, you can only do one thing at a time, and a good writer doesn't get distracted by things. And so if Stephen wants to say, no, I don't really care about institutions, I want to do things not only, you know, I want to do things like through the sheer force of will or personality or you know, extra constitutional, you know, means or whatever, I'm going to let him, you know, decide how he would handle that if you put it to him today relative to when he wrote the book. And I don't know, maybe he wants to elaborate on it more, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I just don't think, you know, it's prudent for us to not realize what is or is not possible without risking the polity itself. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's right. That's kind of what I was going for, and I wasn't trying to put you in the position of having to speak for Stephen. It's more that the irony of exercising prudence the way that's outlined for magisterial Protestants as he's interpreted it is to do the opposite of what he recommends.
Yeah, and I think there's something else. Do you mind if I
go? It's yes.
Yeah, is I think one of the problems here is that we've created a kind of false dichotomy between things that are voluntary and things that are involuntary. And so whenever the state, quote unquote, and if you know the libertarian literature, right, it's you know, the individual versus the state.
Literally nothing else exists.
Right, right. It's the individual, yeah, or it's the state. Now, you know, some of the more sophisticated folks in that world, you know, they'll start to talk about civil society and voluntary association,
right,
and things
that.
Like that, right? But at the end, in the end, a lot of these just come down to sort of, you know, as Bentham said, you know, it's sort of an aggregate of individuals, and so it turns out the individuals don't, you know, they want to avoid that, of having the individuals just become, you know, lost in the associations. And so they might talk about associations, but at the end of the day, the anthropology, and what I mean by that is just understanding of human nature, is very thin. And so, you know, one way to think about this is to start talking about it in terms of like parents and children. But then, of course, the reply to that is, well, the state is not a parent. And look, I get that. But the larger point is that when you think about, you know, human behavior and how people make decisions, and I'm not drifting into, you know, something in psychology or sociology or something like that, But, you know, people, this goes back to Plato, right? I mean, people take cues. And if you close things, if things are closed until noon, you know, people have to ask themselves, what's going on Sunday before noon, right? Like, what would we be encouraging through that, and what sort of thing? It's not that we're discouraging people from going out to eat on Sunday morning. Like, that's a bad thing. We're encouraging them to go to church, which is a good thing. So, you know, could that influence some people to go to church? Well, according to the study, the deaths of despair were related to the blue laws. The implication being that when people were more involved in church, they were less likely to succumb to deaths of despair. Now, that seems like an interesting discussion worth having around the question of human flourishing. And if you just, you know, turn this into, well, this state is telling us what individuals can do on Sunday morning, I have rights, it seems to me that that discourse has not led to more freedom in America. It's actually led to less, because now the idea of rights has just become a way to actually, at the end of the day, get a bigger and bigger state, especially a federal state, as the rights in the Bill of Rights and all of the shadows and penumbras therein have been, become a tool after incorporation to actually make people less free.
The paper I think we're talking about here is called Opiates of the Masses, Deaths of Despair, and the Decline of American Religion by Tyler Giles, Daniel M. Hungerman, and Tamar Ustrom. And the abstract says, in recent decades, death rates from poisoning, suicides, and alcoholic liver disease have dramatically increased in the United States. We show that these deaths of despair began to increase relative to trend in the early 1990s, that this increase was preceded by a decline in religious participation, and that both trends were driven by middle-aged white Americans. Using repeals of blue laws as a shock to religiosity, we confirm that religious practice has significant effects on these mortality rates. Our findings show that social factors such as organized religion can play an important role in understanding deaths of despair. In other words, the movie Footloose is why your uncle is an alcoholic. That's that last part I added.
I figured.
Yeah.
you mentioned Tim Carney's book earlier. You know, what struck me in listening to Carney's book is he talks about the way in which, and this is the kind of, you know, diminishing of the church, which I'm not fond of, but just to think of it as an organization in which people find community and help and things like that. And the church is so much more than that. But he says that this is the lowest cost of entry place in America, right?
Yeah, I've, you know, wrestled with this problem a little bit myself in a review for Sorab Amari's book, The Unbroken Thread. I talked about how a lot of these rules are selectively enforced in places where there are religious minorities that do not observe the same Sabbath. So there were a lot of shakedowns of Jewish business leaders who then had to essentially incur a tax to hire what was called the House Goy that operated the business on Saturday, which is the Jewish Sabbath. And now that we have a large number of Muslims living in this country, I guess we'll need a house haram. I don't know. It could work on Fridays. So it gets complicated, but this is when you devolve the question to local communities, right?
Right. I think that's right. And, you know, I think Mark has suggested, you know, having a
Mark David Hall.
Yeah. Suggested that you could have Friday, Saturday, or Sunday as a designated Sabbath. Now, I understand, you know, I'm going to be an advocate for Sunday, and I'm going to be an advocate for that on different fronts. And I think this gets back to the magisterial point, Stephen's point, which is, I guess I'll just ask the question this way, and this is where, again, I don't just want to turn the church into an association, and I don't just want to promote religiosity as a good. But if you were to say to me, look, we can have things as they are right now, or we can have some acknowledgement of the importance of worship and give people fewer reasons, I might say, well, you know, we can do it like we did it in 1950. Or, I don't know, maybe there's another way. Maybe there's a way, and I'm thinking to, like, the SCOTUS accommodation of the postal carrier, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a new way to think about this. And maybe there's a way, and this would be my ideal, where we're advancing the Christian faith, and we're not entirely neutral, but to the point of both prudence and a certain amount of pragmatism, we're able to accommodate these other faiths too, insofar as we want to keep the integrity of the polity, and we don't want to encourage, you know, sedition and tumult, as Althusius would say.
Well, on that optimistic note, do you have anything coming out, anything for the listeners to search out if they're hungry for more moots?
I've got some pieces at Law and Liberty. I just had my first piece at American Reformer go up. I reviewed Mark's book on the role of Christians in advancing liberty and equality at the Acton. Is it Religion and Liberty? That's it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. There, I will be having some kind of occasional review pieces coming out probably in the next month. And then I've got some other things that I'm kind of, you know, chipping away on, but there's no point in really talking about those until they're, you know, closer to publication.
You heard it here, folks. There's more moots. You know what, Glenn?
Public discourse. My review of Stephen's book. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, if you couldn't tell, Glenn and I have been friends for a long time. So this was a slightly less structured podcast than maybe it should have been. But, I hope everybody, learned a lot. Glenn's definitely one of the people that you want to look to for a measured, and even sympathetic reading of Christian nationalism rather than the hair-pulling house on fire kind of stuff that you get. Thank you so much for appearing on The Sower, Glenn.
Thanks, James. It's always great to spend time with you, albeit, you know, virtually, and keep up the good work.
Man, we did it. We got this podcast done. It only took 7 months. Bye.
See ya.